Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and to kick off this episode, as is the new tradition, Jeremy Slevin joins us in studio for a roundup of what's going on in the news in poverty this week. Jeremy.
Great to be here. Lots of news this week.
What's going on? Without further ado.
So some good news out of Wisconsin. A court tossed out Scott Walker's new plan to drug test food stamp or SNAP recipients. That would be an unprecedented move. A lot of states do it for TANF, but Scott Walker wanted to do it for welfare recipients, and that was thrown out by a federal judge. So good news there.
I mean, I like it. You look like you like it. And not just because it's, you know, Schadenfreude, also because it's good policy.
Right, right. Some less good news. Harvard, the cafeteria workers are leading a campus strike for a living wage. These workers are asking for a minimum wage of $35,000 a year, which is still less than half of what the students pay in housing and tuition. Also a lot less than the Harvard endowment of $35 billion.
Billion with a B.
Billion with a B. But so far, no end in sight for the strike.
And that has gotten a lot of attention. So I have to say, points to the media, the mainstream media, for actually covering that a lot.
Yes. On something that hasn't got as much attention in the mainstream media, there is a nationwide prison strike that kicked off last month. By some estimates, it's hard to tell with limited reporting, but by some estimates, it's up to 24,000 inmates across 12 states who are still on strike for better labor conditions. And right now, prisoners, like many others, are exempt from the minimum wage and are often just paid pennies to do prison labor. It's unclear how much longer that strike will go on. So I think in some states it's stopped. But a lot less attention has been paid to that than, for example, this Harvard strike.
And something that we've explored over at talkpoverty.org.
Yes, yes.
So just to give us a shameless plug for doing better than the mainstream media, which is our goal every week, why we exist.
And some other bad news out of Ohio. Ohio had actually purged, by some estimates, over a million voters from their voter rolls. These are voters who had not voted in 2012 and 2014, but were registered to vote. And under an Ohio Voter Restriction Act, they were purged, which was also ruled illegal by a federal court. But now not all of those voters may get their rights back. They're currently in a legal battle. So
something that could have a real impact in November.
Absolutely.
As we discussed last week.
Yeah. So that's it for the big news. Obviously, we have the final presidential debate coming up on Wednesday. We hope that the moderators will ask the real questions about, you know, the policies that matter to working families, but it remains to be seen.
Something a lot of folks were frustrated about watching last week. I know I was in that camp, particularly given that there had been so much momentum and energy around the sending over of questions for the moderators to ask, because it was a town hall style debate. Yet, despite the fact that some of the questions that were most popular by people who voted, whether they were on Social Security or the economy, just didn't get asked at all.
Yeah, you had almost 4 million people submit questions from this presidential open debates campaign, and the moderators had initially said they were going to take these questions, but the questions they asked bared no correlation to how the questions that people wanted them to ask, which I think a lot of people were disappointed in.
I mean, one bright spot, of course, was the rise of the star of Ken Bone, whom we invited to be on this show this week.
How did that pan out?
Well, we haven't heard back from him yet. Ken Bone, if you're listening,
if you're out there, Ken,
we would love to have you on the show, not just to discuss your status as an undecided voter, but more importantly, your terrific fashion sense, which has spawned, I'm sure, Halloween costume inspiration nationwide.
Ken Bone almost made up for the lack of questions on poverty or low income.
Almost. He came very close.
Not quite.
He came very close. But he also provided tremendous cover to our dear colleague, Sean Fremstad, who is an avid listener and also a regular guest on this show.
Our dear colleague and Ken Bone doppelganger.
Well, I will say Sean rocks a red cardigan like very few. And if you know him, you know I am speaking only the truth. But Ken Bone, very helpful to Sean Fremstad. So that was a win. So, Jeremy, thank you so much for the news this week.
Anytime.
We've got a great episode lined up. We first will be speaking with Sarah Smarsh. She is a really very smart columnist and journalist who covers class in America and also a native Kansan, talking about what the media gets wrong when it comes to the white working class. And to commemorate Disability Employment Awareness Month, we'll also be speaking with the filmmaker behind a new film on subminimum wage, how it is legal to pay workers with disabilities far less than the nation's federal minimum wage.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. No voting bloc has been more focused on during this election cycle than the white working class, which many pundits and analysts have pointed to as driving the rise behind both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. However, as Sarah Smarsh argues in a column published earlier this week in The Guardian, they are also perhaps the most misunderstood. She notes that Trump supporters are not the caricatures journalists depict. Sarah Smarsh is a journalist who covers class in America and a native Kansan. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you use incredibly sharp language in what I find to be a really smart column. You and I want to start with some of your own words to sort of tell the story that you tell. You say that media makers, and I'm quoting here, cast the white working class as a monolith and imply an old treacherous story convenient to capitalism that the poor are dangerous idiots, close quote. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, I think the first place to begin in breaking that down is that poor whites, as is the case with anyone in poverty in this country, have very little or no voice in public and political discourse. That's for a variety of reasons: lack of access to formal higher education, and just some all of our the known societal disadvantages to people in poverty that preclude them from ending up working in places like newsrooms that cover the communities of America. And so we've seen the mass media's blind spot to class this election cycle is ever present, of course, but really has come into focus in news coverage attempting to explain various uprisings of populism in the country, which has sort of been this first forced occasion for national media to reckon with corners of the country that they're so far removed from by both income and geography that these stereotypical depictions arise in that space.
One of the stereotypical depictions that you provide an example of in this column is sort of faces, quote, hateful faces screaming sexist vitriol next to Confederate flags. Is that the way that white working class voters have been depicted in this election?
Yeah, I would say on the whole, yes. You know, they're just this has been, of course, a historic and exceedingly polarizing election season, as everyone knows and is experiencing. And that has really left nuance off the table often. And so I think that, you know, if we had to name the single one-dimensional vision of an economically disenfranchised white person, this news year would be, what that line describes, the racist and misogynist and utterly foul person screaming hateful epithets. Now, that person and varieties on him certainly exist, but in my essay, I hope, makes no defense of them. That certainly wasn't my intention, but rather my intention was to point out that those same threads of hate, sexism, racism, xenophobia, homophobia, all of the above, are not for someone's class, but rather for her character. And they certainly exist just in different forms at all socioeconomic strata of this country.
Now, as you put it, these kinds of one-dimensional stereotypes are permitted to abound when journalism fails to do its job. What types of failures are you seeing? What's missing? What should the coverage actually be doing if it were to accurately depict the white working class that you know?
Well, I think the first thing would certainly be to get out, you know, on the ground, out with the people that a reporter is intending to cover. And by that, I mean for more than just like 10 minutes of hopping into a truck with someone to ask a couple of political questions. And, you know, I do think that the news media has really snapped into place in a lot of ways in recent months, doing the work of fact-checking and calling out erroneous ideas and statistics that get thrown around in a manner of propaganda. And so, I don't mean to suggest that, and I'm a journalist myself, and I take great pride in the profession. I don't mean to suggest that overwhelmingly they have failed, but in terms of their relationship specifically to poor whites, I would say, or working class whites, let's say, there just is such a gulf so often between their own experiences in often New York or coastal newsrooms and the people that they're trying to cover that the personal biases of the reporter can so easily emerge. The only way to get past those is to be out on the ground in the spaces that need covered, meeting people where they are and seeing them as human beings. I would add that my piece was really intending to critique the most powerful national media empires, and I have, as many journalists, worked before at a local small town newspapers newsroom, and that's a very different. There's still some potential issues involving economic privilege and who ends up working in that newsroom as opposed to running the press. But I do think that local news is a different animal and usually gets this right to a greater extent.
And you do lift up one example of someone that you argue has done this well, Alexander Zaychik, who did sort of shoe leather journalism on the ground in six states talking to white working class folks. And he described the people that he spoke with and met on that journey as a, quote, blue collar middle class. Tell me a little bit about what Alexander Zaychik did and what he found.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, the first place that I saw his new book referenced was, I think, an interview with a Washington newspaper. And so I picked it up and was just thought it was so utterly refreshing that not only did he go to, he visited six different states. It was a, pretty diverse geographical strategy, but he really spent time. His mission, by the way, was to speak with people who are stated as Trump supporters. And so there was some sort of potentially self-selecting things going on in variables in terms of where he ended up. But he went to Trump rallies and spoke with a broad swath of Trump supporters. And one of the things that really struck me about his book is he took a really kind of Studs Terkel working tact of a heavy component of oral history. So there might be two whole pages in this book where one disabled veteran in a bar in Phoenix gets to speak about why he's for Trump. And it's a really enlightening piece of reporting in terms of just kind of the complexities and nuance of what make people tick. And I want to say that he in no way as a writer is making a defense of a vote for Trump. but that wasn't his mission. His mission was just to listen to people and not speak for them or about them or to them, but give them a platform from which to speak. And I think that's the real paradigm shift that I would hope to see in national media.
Now, race has been a big part of the conversation in this election cycle, and particularly pertaining to discussions about white working class voters who, as you point out in your essay, are often characterized and somewhat monolithically as being being bigots or being racists. And you actually you cite as one example of this a radio show that I really enjoy and find very smart, On the Media. And the host of that show actually describing white working class voters as subscribing, quote, to certain views that are undoubtedly racist, and you can't mask it and pretend it's not there. It's very much a part of their thinking. Do you think that that's a fair characterization of the population we're talking about?
Well, first I should say, in case, and maybe I misunderstood you, but it was the woman being interviewed by the On the Media host who that quote is attributed to, Nancy Eisenberg, author of a new history book called White Trash. But to your question, I don't think that's fair. And I want to say that's not because I claim to know whether said population is or isn't those things. But it's because it's unfair more because you can't make that generalization about any large group of people. And B, it just kind of strikes me, as I point out in the essay, as glaringly obvious that you wouldn't make that generalization about most any other large group of people in this country without deserved outrage in response. So let's say, you know, this pronoun they, if you applied it in parallel terms to another disenfranchised group that doesn't have as much voice to voice a dispute with your claim, it would I think strike a reader as problematic to say, let's say, all people of a certain minority group undoubtedly hold this particular view. It's just another version of turning a group into a monolith, and that, again, is not to, of course, racism and all of these woes exist among the white underclass. But my point is twofold. One, it doesn't permeate that the entire white underclass, and B, it certainly exists among higher class affluent white Americans as well.
And you also make the point that one of the reasons that this so-called blind spot really has been permitted to exist within the mainstream media is a lack of socioeconomic diversity within their ranks. What drives that lack of diversity, and is that what you think is fueling this limited and sort of unnuanced discussion?
Well, there are probably people more equipped in terms of economics to weigh in on that and sociology. But my theory as a working journalist who is from a place where people don't become journalists, my theory in answer to your question would be that the same things that keep certain groups from any place of professional privilege or so-called white-collar jobs are the same forces at work in keeping them out of journalism. That would be, lack of access, financial access to higher education, and myriad other issues. But I would add to that people who have been born into socioeconomic disadvantage are arguably, and this is just my personal take, no studies to go along with this, although they may well exist, they're arguably the least likely to believe that someone wants to hear what they have to say. So there's a kind of inherent psychological barrier to entering the profession of communications, which, of course, goes far beyond commentary and one's own personal perspective. Even just the power that goes with having your name as a byline in a newspaper, I mean, that struck me as like the height of distant fame and fortune when I was a kid in rural Kansas. So, and for many people in this country is just taken for granted as a right that of course, your story would be published or have a chance to be. So I think the issues are really complex in both restricting access to the field, but also potentially someone from where I'm from might not even occur to them as an option.
You also make the point that it's not just mainstream or even news media, right? I should say news media, not so much mainstream media, but news media. It's also pop culture. And you actually, you make a reference to the television show Roseanne, which in many ways was perhaps one of the last times that a major network show focused on white working class individuals. Do you see pop culture continuing to sort of miss the boat on these issues or caricaturing white working class individuals in the same way that the news media is?
I absolutely do. And I point out in my piece for The Guardian that I'm taking my own industry to task because that's a place where I have, I'm able to speak and I think that we can do better. That's not to suggest that classism is the province of the news media. It is just a phenomenon that pervades our society, regardless of profession. Certainly, all manner of pop culture are complicit in the kind of stereotypes I'm trying to break down. And in fact, I think that a lot of television shows, in particular, right now, I'd say more cable TV, are doing some really interesting work in examining class. I'm not a huge TV buff, but feel like I can make that generalization. At the same time, the entertainment sources that are most accessible to the kind of people whose depictions I'm looking at on, say, like network television, are often the most reductive and harmful. And in that realm of just, relatively free to access TV and news and quote unquote mainstream information. I mentioned the TV show Roseanne as the really first and only time in my entire life that I felt like I looked at a TV screen and saw an accurate reflection of a life that I recognized from the storylines about financial struggle to the witty, strong women that had economic power in the household because they have always been working and were doing so long before World War II. Even the set of that show I started watching when I was a kid in the late 80s, and the set of their living room included a nubby brown 1970s couch. So it was like even the set design got it right, that your furniture is going to be at least 10 years old. Details like that are so are usually missed in pop culture. And so I think that show probably was underrated by critics because they weren't equipped with the life experience to see how right she got it. And She really did get it right.
I'm speaking with Sarah Smarsh. She is a journalist who covers class issues. She's also a native Kansan, and she wrote a column for The Guardian this week about the white working class and how misunderstood they are. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. Sarah, I'm also curious to dig in a little bit to your thoughts on journalistic bias. Often it is said or held up that journalism is or can be unbiased and is just telling the facts. You argue that it is imbued with bias and actually with class bias.
For sure. I was part of the last class at my journalism school at the University of Kansas to receive a kind of traditional hard news print training right before the term media convergence became all-consuming in the industry and multimedia reigned. So it was a very kind of stringent, detail-oriented, hard-ass focus training us to write for newspapers. And part of that kind of 20th century approach to journalism was that this holding this idea of objectivity in high regard. And I want to say that even though I now often write in the first person and I bring my and I wear my own personal affections on my sleeve as I write, I do still hold in high regard the virtue in separating one's own politics to what extent one can from, let's say, hard news reporting. We need front page news stories that aren't someone yapping about his own journey to find the story, you know. That said, I think that we can simultaneously hold the truth that even in deciding whom to interview for the hard news story, in comes just often unacknowledged and unspoken biases, even for all of our best intentions. And that is true in so many ways about the human condition. This isn't a fault of journalists. It's humanity. And so I think that the way that we can expand past that is to engage the largest diversity of voices possible now that we have all these technological tools at our hands to do so, more and more people speak for themselves rather than a certain privileged pack of Americans describing the rest of the country.
A phrase that often gets used in this conversation, and I should say it's not brand new that the media are focused on working class or white working class voters. I'm struck every time I repeat that you're a native Kansan, that perhaps the most well-known tome on this subject is Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? But a phrase that is often used to describe disaffected Democrats who are low-income individuals and who end up switching parties or joining Republican ranks, they're often described as, quote, voting against their best interests. You argue that that is not just a condescending characterization, but that it's also undemocratic. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I admire Thomas Frank's work and his character and often very brave perspective in going counter to his own political and class realm. His more recent book is called Listen, Liberal, that really takes the left to task for leaving working Americans behind. I agree with him on a lot. I can't get behind the notion of people voting against best interests as a critique, and here's why. First of all, I of course might sit in my house and think that about other people based on the data available to me, and I might pass that judgment, but I think it's a really dangerous idea to throw around, and I don't think this was Thomas Frank's intention, but I think it's often how this gets peddled, is that they are voting against their best interests, and therefore they're fools who are not equipped to cast a ballot in an election. I've actually seen pieces of political discourse this year arguing that there should be, you know, in reputable publications, arguing that there should be knowledge tests in order to vote. That, of course, was a tactic cleverly applied in the Jim Crow South to keep black voters from voting. So I just think it's a very slippery slope to start casting that particular judgment. And, you know, I also want to say that I take issue with the idea that it almost, in a paradoxical way, gives a pass to someone for a vote that would, let's say, voting for a candidate that would be bad for America. I want to say, you know, I'm from a place where most people didn't go to college, and that doesn't necessarily actually mean that they know less about the country or things that would inform a vote about the issues. Their knowledge might be come in different forms than data and statistics, and it might be more experiential. But for whatever their reasons and whatever their votes, they're you know, the white working class are brilliant, creative people without whose skills and ingenuity the infrastructure of this country would grind to a halt. Well, of course, that's true of working class people of all colors. And so I want to say, if someone casts a vote that I find reprehensible, he's damn well going to own it. He was capable of it and should bear responsibility for it. I didn't give myself a pass growing up based on where I came from, and I'm not going to start handing those out now.
My guest is Sarah Smarsh. She is the author of an essay in The Guardian published earlier this week. It's titled Dangerous Idiots: How the Liberal Media Elite Failed Working Class Americans. And Sarah, I want to close with your words, which I think outline the importance and timeliness of the argument that you make. You note that, quote, the economic trench between reporter and reported on has never been more hazardous than at this moment of historic wealth disparity, though when stories focus more often on the stock market than on people who own no stocks. Sarah Smarsh, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, and thank you for your essay.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. The Fair Labor Standards Act, enacted in 1938, put in place a federal wage floor for the first time in our nation's history. At the bill's signing, President Roosevelt declared it the most far-sighted program for the benefit of workers that has ever been adopted here or in any other country. Some groups were left largely unprotected by the legislation, and one in particular, workers with disabilities. Under a special provision of the law, they can legally be paid far less than the federal minimum wage, simply because they have a disability. A new film explores the impact of this policy on Americans with disabilities. To discuss the film, as well as the issue of sub-minimum wages for workers with disabilities, I'm joined in studio by the filmmaker Jordan Melagrana and Cheryl Bates Harris, an advocate with the National Disability Rights Network. Thanks to you both so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jordan, I want to start with you. What got you interested in making this film?
Well, my day job is at a project called Rooted in Rights, which is a video and social media project exclusively focused on disability rights. We're based at Disability Rights Washington in Seattle. And the reason we started that project was to talk about disability rights issues nationally. So how we choose to take on video projects is we listen to our community via social media primarily and also with our outreach in the real world. There are no shortage of disability rights issues that would make a great film. But there are two giant issues that the community seems to care about more than anything, and subminimum wage is definitely one of those. And frankly, I had never heard of it before. I had, like many other people, when you hear being paid less than minimum wage, you think maybe waiters and waitresses, tip workers. I didn't realize this was even a thing, let alone that it was legal. So when I heard about it, it's reminded me of a lot of the prior work I had done on wage theft and undocumented workers being paid less than minimum wage and all kinds of other things that I found to be unjust and would make for good stories, and so this seemed to be in that mold. And as soon as I started talking about it with some of our allies across the country, there was enormous interest in doing a film about it. So it was kind of a no-brainer for us that we would go out and try to find these stories.
So Cheryl Bates-Harris, you are an expert on this issue, on disability law and disability rights. Help us understand, how is it legal that people with disabilities can be paid less than the federal minimum wage that applies to everyone else?
Well, it goes back to a post-war piece of legislation where men were primarily the wage earners, and we had primarily a manufacturing economy. So as veterans returned from war with injuries that would limit their ability to work in a manufacturing society, the 14C provision was put into place to allow men the dignity to continue working, even if they were not, quote unquote, as productive as others. So that's how it started. Unfortunately, it was not until we deinstitutionalized children and they needed a place to go during the day that people really realized that this was a loophole that would allow them to pay people less than minimum wage if they brought work in for those individuals to do.
And one of the pieces of history that the film explores is really the rise of what are often called sheltered workshops. Jordan, what are sheltered workshops? And tell us a little bit of how they came into place.
Well, that's a question I asked a lot over the last year, and I got a lot of different answers about how you define a sheltered workshop. There's no dictionary definition of it. And the sheltered workshops are not even the whole story. There are places that are not workshops where people go that can be paid subminimum wage. There are other types of work that make use of this. But a sheltered workshop is the most famous example. And essentially what that is picture a factory down a road that you don't normally drive down, that people with disabilities go for, you know, as Cheryl says, for a period of time during the day. The idea is that they will go there, they'll be able to work on contracts that get brought in from the outside. It's usually manufacturing, shredding papers, sorting parts, things like that. And then the idea is that people will go there and this will give them an opportunity to earn a little bit of money, get some jobs, training skills, get some social skills, and then over a period of time, then be able to transition out to some kind of community employment. That does happen occasionally, and sometimes it happens over a very, very long period of time. There's a gentleman in the film from Mississippi who had been at a workshop for 15 years, this gentleman named Tillman Mitchell from Vicksburg. And at the end of those 15 years, he was finally placed in a community job. They only started looking for him in that last year of that 15 years. And the job they found for him was he's a houseman at a La Quinta Inn. And I met Tillman. There's no question in my mind it would not take 15 years for him to learn how to wipe down a vending area or vacuum a floor. I just don't believe that. And that seems to be the pattern that we've found. And Cheryl can talk more about this because she did the investigations over time at the NDRN that looked at a lot of these examples of people being in workshops for 10, 20, 30 years. That doesn't sound like a training program to me.
Cheryl, you argue in the film that sheltered workshops started for the right reason, but that they have since become an outdated model of segregation. What did you mean by that? And tell us a little bit more about these workshops and the investigations that NDRN has done.
Well, the workshops originally started, I'm going to say, the late 50s, 60s, and certainly they flourished in the 70s. And the thought then was we were just starting to educate children in public schools. And so these were kids that parents had kept out of institutions that needed a place to go during the day. So when somebody thought about, well, let's try to teach them some job skills and think about employment, that's when the 14C was discovered. And what's happened, unfortunately, is businesses contract work to the sheltered workshops, and the businesses make good money off of these contracts. So they have an incentive to keep people there in order to get the production work done. And so instead of being a train and place model, individuals are, it's a road to nowhere. People end up in the sheltered workshops. Most people will either die or retire from sheltered workshops.
And what, I mean, Jordan mentioned work that might involve wiping down countertops, but what types of work are people frequently doing in these workshops? I know it can range.
It's very tedious, repetitive, and low-skilled work. Assembly, counting out nuts and bolts for, like, the furniture that you put together that you buy from IKEA. Shredding newspapers is very common. Stringing linoleum tiles together. Putting product samples together. And the most unfortunate part is that the work that comes in, everybody has to do it. People don't get to choose the kinds of jobs they do, nor do they get to, nor are they matched with their skills and abilities. And that's consequently the reason of the subminimum wage. People don't have dexterity skills for a lot of these. People don't have any interest in it. They get bored. It's just, you know, not a good job match. And they're stuck.
And that is definitely a theme that recurs throughout the film. Let's play a little bit of tape from one worker describing how the work he was assigned to do didn't match at all with his skills or abilities.
My name is LaRon Jackson. Sometimes I think they match the people up with the wrong task because they don't really want to take the time to match them to what they can do. Like when I was in the shelter workshop, they had me bending over, putting clothes in the barrel. I had CP, so I couldn't bend over and then get myself back up. It took me a while to get myself back up. I had to ask somebody to get me up so I can reposition myself and then pick up some clothing and then bend back down to put it in the barrel. And after I got that check of $2.50 for working in a hot workshop with hot big fans, I said I quit. I can go find me something else to do.
So in addition to the mismatch of work that people can be assigned to do, people also are paid very little. And obviously that's the thrust of this film, that the title of the film is Bottom Dollars, which couldn't sum up better what's going on here. But how much do people actually get paid for this work, Jordan?
Well, none of this is really a secret. If you go to the Department of Labor's website, they have a spreadsheet where it actually shows where every single 14C holder is in the entire country. And so what we did is we took that and we did a Freedom of Information request. And we looked at several sheltered workshops, some of them which appear in the film and others which were just the biggest ones by number of people employed. And we saw some wages that were above minimum wage in the $9 area. We saw some that were more around the federal minimum wage. But then there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people being paid $5 an hour, $3 an hour, $2 an hour, 50 cents an hour, down to 2 cents an hour, 3 cents an hour.
2 cents an hour.
2 cents an hour.
And there are people in the film who actually describe after a day of incredibly tedious, as you mentioned, Cheryl, and also in some cases somewhat grueling work because of the mismatch with their abilities or skills, receiving their paycheck and it ends up being like $2.50 or $5 for an entire pay period.
Yeah, and there's a gentleman we ran into named LaRon Jackson, the clip we just played, and he worked in a sheltered workshop, and he was completely mismatched. They had him gathering up clothes and putting it in the barrel, and then they would basically weigh the barrel at the end of the day and then pay him based on that. And he has cerebral palsy. He doesn't have great dexterity. He describes it pretty well in the film, how kind of ridiculous it was that he was assigned this job. And what I think about when I think about LaRon is that he is now working at Disability Rights Mississippi. He is now an advocate who goes into sheltered workshops to help people get out. He's has his undergrad degree, and he's planning to go to law school. So we had a guy who will probably go to law school, get an advanced degree, and become a lawyer one day. And we thought it would be a good idea to put him in the sheltered workshop and assign him to sort clothing. That doesn't strike me as starting with high expectations for someone or starting with what someone's dreams are, what they want to do.
Cheryl, do we have a sense of how many Americans with disabilities currently work in sheltered workshops or more broadly for the subminimum wage?
The numbers vary tremendously. I've heard 400,000 individuals in sheltered workshops. I've heard the number as high as 685,000 individuals. It's difficult to know exactly how many people are there because not all states track it. And again, when you look at the Department of Labor data, I think Jordan's film indicated there's like 261 plus thousand earning subminimum wage. I think the point, though, is that the 14C certificate denies people the prevailing wage regardless. Just by virtue of the fact that they have a disability, they're paid based on their productivity. So the productivity could put them above minimum wage, but they're still being paid separately than a non-disabled person would be if they were doing the same job.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. I'm speaking with Jordan Melagrana and Cheryl Bates-Harris about a new film exploring the subminimum wage for workers with disabilities. It's called Bottom Dollars. But Cheryl, staying with you, some people who defend this policy, and I'll play devil's advocate here, argue that if we were to abolish the subminimum wage and pay everyone the same fair wage, that certain people with disabilities wouldn't have access to job opportunities at all, that there wouldn't be jobs for them. Do you think that that's a valid criticism?
Not necessarily. I think the criticism is based on an assumption that people with disabilities are not capable. And I think that if we really take the time to get to know individuals with disabilities, recognize what they're interested in, what it is that makes them sparkle and shine, so to speak, that there is a job out there for everyone, that everyone has talent. It just takes some time to figure out what it is that that person can do. And I think the first thing that has to happen is we have to have a paradigm shift and assume employability rather than assume that people are incapable and can't work.
Jordan, is that a criticism that you've heard in response to this film?
Yes, and that's the go-to argument, is that if we stop paying people 2 cents an hour, then where will they work? I think it's rooted in how this all started. As Cheryl described in the history, it was started as a way to get people with disabilities a job, because when it started, employers would not hire people with disabilities. There was no protection in the law. They could discriminate against people based on disability. That's no longer the case today. Kids with disabilities were not going to school in 1938. That's not the case today. I think that if we start with the premise that people with disabilities will be able to go out and get jobs just like their non-disabled peers, then I don't think we'll be in this situation. And in addition to the, you know, outright ableism that is involved in this issue, there's also some very familiar phrasing here. I live in Seattle. We raised our minimum wage to $15. We will be raising it to $15. And people, you know, screamed from the hilltop that, you know, Seattle will go out of business. Restaurants won't be able to survive. You know, Armageddon will break loose. It's just not the case. I think the exact opposite's happened, if I read my numbers correctly, and I don't expect that to happen. So there's just an unwillingness in some ways. There's a cultural barrier here that people who run shelter workshops often, at least the people I talk to, and as I think Cheryl has put in the past, they're doing God's work. They're doing the right thing. They're helping people out. And so they're coming from that place, and so it's very difficult to think about things in a new paradigm. You have parents of people with disabilities who for decades have relied on this as a way to help them care for their children and adult children, and they don't necessarily see the vision of their child going out and getting a job. And one of the goals of this film was to not just talk about the problem, but really spend half the film talking about solutions and how people with different disabilities from all over the country are skipping shelter workshops entirely and going right into integrated employment. So there's a lot of those barriers. And then some of it's just good old-fashioned profiteering. There's some folks who run sheltered workshops who make quite a bit of money. And in Cheryl's monitoring, I know they have said, you know, if we had to pay half of minimum wage, we would go out of business. And I just don't think that's true. I don't think that's an exaggeration. This would also probably be a good time to mention that originally the subminimum wage was only supposed to be 75% of the minimum wage. That's how it started. And the bottom has dropped out of that. That was lowered to 50%. I'm going to get my years wrong, but a couple decades later, that was lowered to 50% of minimum wage. And then eventually there was no requirement. And that's why we see 2 cents an hour, 3 cents an hour.
And you mentioned at the top of the segment, the tipped minimum wage, which actually has a similar history as well in terms of being delinked from the federal minimum wage, and which explains why it's lost its value as well. But you mentioned Seattle's successful effort to raise the minimum wage to $15. And I think that's a good segue into talking a little bit about the fight for 15, which has played out incredibly successfully and garnered tremendous momentum across the country in states and in cities. But in many of those state and local battles, people with disabilities are entirely left out from the solution that ends up being pushed. How are people with disabilities being left out of these state and local battles, Jordan?
Well, I mean, the results of it is kind of the proof in the pudding. The wage laws in Seattle, the New York compromise that raised the minimum wage there, none of them will affect the subminimum wage in either of those places. Unfortunately, in Seattle, if I'm not mistaken, there's only one 14C holder left, but that's not the case for all of Washington, and I imagine that the minimum wage will be raised there. I think that, and I have not talked to Fight for 15 activists, but I don't know that, like the general public, they're aware of this. That might be entirely the problem, and that even though 3 years ago there was a massive protest against Goodwill talking about subminimum wages, you know, I work in progressive media, and I didn't hear about that until I started doing this film. And so I think that's the biggest barrier, not only for Fight for 15 activists, but everybody, is that they haven't heard of this. And, you know, that's why we wanted to make the film. That's why we talk about it on social media. That's why we're trying to do these screenings around the country. I think if people know about it, it will become a much bigger piece of that kind of activism.
So, Cheryl, your organization, the National Disability Rights Network, as we mentioned earlier, has done a lot of monitoring, a lot of investigation of these employers, these workshops. But you've also been heavily involved over the years in seeking reform of this policy. What other types of reform efforts are underway?
I think there's a number of different things. I mean, we have talked about ending subminimum wage altogether, but there's a great fear that if you open up the Fair Labor Standard Act to tweak the 14C provision, that other things will happen. So it's really about educating people about other services and options that are out there. We know that people with even the most significant disabilities can work. We have the Rehabilitation Act that specifically provides funding to states to provide services and supports to people with disabilities. It requires, or the law states, that they should be providing services to individuals with the most significant disabilities, yet these are the ones who have been in the sheltered workshop. So it's really about monitoring the VR agencies, making sure that they're providing the appropriate services. VR being vocational rehabilitation, making sure that they're not ignoring people with the most significant disabilities, challenging them by referring individuals there, kind of, you know, one person at a time, making families aware that there are other alternatives and making people with disabilities aware of the fact that they have the right to ask for a real job with real wages.
In addition to advocacy for either increased education or for ending the subminimum wage altogether, Cheryl, has litigation ever been tried to overturn this policy?
Yes. In fact, there is a lawsuit in Oregon that was just recently settled where they sued the state. Oregon, 10 years ago, was considered the progressive state in the country in terms of their appropriate transition services for youth with disabilities. And then all of a sudden, the transition stopped, or the transition was individuals went directly to sheltered workshops. So they were sued under the ADA for over-reliance on segregated settings. The judge agreed that it was an issue. There was a settlement agreement, and now an order, and I forget how many people, thousands of individuals in Oregon will now be offered services for competitive integrated employment.
The ADA, of course, being the Americans with Disabilities Act. Are similar lawsuits likely to spring up in other places because of the success in Oregon?
There are several states that are currently looking at it. Part of the issue is getting the data to begin with, because we've heard for years that everything, well, that's just anecdotal and people really don't want to leave. So there are a number of states that are looking at similar action in the near future.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm speaking with a filmmaker and a disability advocate about the sub-minimum wage. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This is a particularly timely conversation, not just because of the release of this film, but also because the issue of disability and people with disabilities has really been front and center in this presidential election cycle. We're a 501c3 show. We can't talk about specific candidates, but I think our listeners are well aware of many ways in which it has come up in this cycle. There's also been polling indicating that a wide swath of Americans feel that disability issues actually are very important to them and will inform their choice in November. Jordan, do you feel that the film is having a broader or a wider impact because of the time of its release?
Well, I hope so. We have seen disability rights spring into the political discussion more than we have nationally in a while. And some of that has been, most of that has been due to really great advocates, people with disabilities themselves, who have been writing blogs and making news and making videos, some of whom have worked with Rooted in Rights on that. We've tried to make that a very big part of what we do. We released the film, or we tried to get the film out in October because it's Disability Employment Awareness Month. We released the film in October because we know people are thinking about the election. And we released it this year because many people might not know this, but both party platforms now feature the end of the sub-minimum wage. And we think that kind of no matter who gets into office next year could be a very pivotal time for this, that we have bipartisan buy-in on getting rid of this. It probably almost definitely will be phased out. It's not like it'll end overnight. But if the film can help get the understanding of the issue out there, then I think a lot of the policymakers will feel more comfortable moving forward.
And Cheryl, you at NDRN have been working on this issue for decades. What do you think about the use of film and some of these kinds of new media efforts to shine a light on something that you have been seeking to change for so long?
I think it's brilliant. I think Jordan did an amazing job of pulling together a complicated subject of not only the sub-minimum wage issue, but employment of people with disabilities and demonstrating capability. And I think people will look at videos either on, you know, on media campaigns or whatever. People will watch it and it will catch their attention. And I think it's brilliant.
And staying with you, Cheryl, given the political climate and a lot of the portrayals of disability in the media, as well as in the presidential cycle, do you feel that film is the most powerful or one of the more powerful ways to try to change the sort of idea that many individuals may have of who people with disabilities are?
Yes, although I think there's some good images out there and there's also some bad images out there. I immediately think of the You Before Me, the movie that came out in the summer where a man with a significant disability ends up committing suicide because he doesn't want to live like that. And yet at the same time, there's the new comedy show Speechless, which shows the, you know, frustrations of an overprotective mother in some regard and her son with a disability. disability. So I think that we're starting to see more reflection of people with disabilities in movies and in the media. So, and I think Jordan's movie ought to be right at the top of all of those.
So, Jordan, where can our listeners find more information about the film and figure out how to watch?
Sure. So the film is only as good as what you do in the real world. And so we're distributing this intentionally, not online. You have to hold a screening, and that screening could mean your friends come over to your living room. It could mean at your church, at your school, at your university, at your independent living center, at your P&A. And that's, we're choosing that on purpose because we want people to watch it in a room with other people, talk about it, reach out to the disability community, have a discussion with them, talk to advocates like Cheryl. Our DC premiere, which was earlier this week on Tuesday, was exactly that. We got about 100 people in the room. We watched the film together and we engaged in what I thought was a great discussion about how do we actually figure this out? How do we change this? And we had people from all walks of life in that screening. So if you want to host a screening, and anyone can host a screening, they should go to bottomdollarsmovie.com. There's a really simple form you fill out. Let us know when you're doing it. We'll mail you a DVD. There's a ton of resources on there that you can download, discussion guides, press releases, photos, audio described documents that you can use to set up your screening. Let us know when you're going to do it. We'll help promote it. And we really just want to get it out there. Every single state, every single community. We have 87 screenings so far scheduled across the country, and we would love that number to keep going.
So say that website one more time.
The website is bottomdollarsmovie.com.
I've been speaking with Jordan Melagrana, the filmmaker behind Bottom Dollars, and also Cheryl Bates-Harris, an advocate with the National Disability Rights Network. Thank you both so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe.